G'day, Kava. Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 314. This is, of course, the guy that does the show, named Jeff Phillips Wifferson, a.k.a. Jeff Phillips from America, originally. It's Friday, the 6th of March, 2020. I'm sitting on the beach here beside of a cliff at beautiful Matapuri, which is about 45 minutes out east on the ocean from Whangarei on the North Island of New Zealand. That's Taiki a Maui. And this is going to be my last show for this visit to New Zealand. I've been here since the middle of December, and it's been a very wonderful, fantastic visit. I was lucky enough to be able to spend a month house-sitting in Nelson near the geographical center of New Zealand. Then I was able to go and stay with my beautiful Australian artist friend Kate Burness in Takaka in Golden Bay. Then I spent a few days in Christchurch, where I was able to visit my beautiful tree friends in the botanical garden, Quercus robur, Sequoia dendron giganteum, Eucalyptus delicatensis and her other eucalyptus family from Australia, Cedrus deodara, Ulmus minor, and Douglas fir, and many other beautiful trees too, but those are the main ones I hang out with. And for the past two or three weeks, I've been so lucky to be able to be here at Matapuri, staying in this beautiful big old farmhouse all by myself, in one of the quietest environments I've ever stayed at, and since I can remember, and I can look out every direction and almost not see any other sign of human habitation. There's a little bit of noise here and there, but it's not too bad. So I'm recording this show out sitting off, I'm about 30 meters from the ocean, but I'm kind of around behind a cliff to block the wind that's been extraordinarily strong the past few days. About 2 or 3 days ago, we started having a massive amount of rain, probably about 30 mils, which would be more than an inch of rain. That is really the first major rain since before Christmas here. Everything, it was long and hard enough that even the big trees got a good, nice little drink. And you can just tell everything is so happy. And I wanted to record the show outside. I'd be a little closer and more exposed to the ocean, except for the wind would make the audio really distorted. But where I am is not too bad. You can hear the crashing of the waves. But this show, I don't really have an exact title for it, but it's about my relationship with comets. And it's something I've talked about many times on my show. And in this show, I'm in honor of the fact that I've recently been very lucky enough to get in touch or to be contacted by both William Napier and Victor Kluge, two of the most legendary comet astronomers and researchers that have ever existed. And Bill Napier lives in Ireland and Victor Kluge lives in France. And I sent them both hand-painted rocks a few weeks ago, and both of them have got in touch with me and thanked them. And especially Victor Kluge now is opening a channel of email discourse with me, and I might convince him to do a radio show. I haven't really tried about that yet, but so I'm going to talk about the evolution of my personal relationship with comets. I think they're very significant entities or beings in the history of Earth and the history of life on Earth. But first, some news, or maybe I should say some infotoxin. As you all are very well aware, there's this insidious media infection going around about this thing called the coronavirus, and it's really nothing to be scared of. The whole point is to make people scared and to use every psychological warfare tactic that exists. And it's being manipulated in the exact same way as the Australian bushfires, although that was actually had a much higher degree of reality. And sure, the coronavirus or something is making people sick and maybe killing a few, but the bottom line is, given the validity of any of the statistics, which I really honestly, I mean, one of the things this whole thing is calling into question for a lot of people is just how much of the bullshit from mass media can we ever continue to believe? I mean, I've been saying this for decades, but it's just become so obvious to people now. But, you know, there's this thing called the influenza, this kind of common disease that happens every year. And a lot more people die from that every year and get sick, like millions, tens of millions. And so, but is that the news? No, the coronavirus, which is, it's been around for a long time. I mean, it's commonly known. It's even, if you look at the labels on some of your common household cleaners like Lysol spray and things like that, it mentions that it'll kill coronavirus. So if this shit will kill it, what's anybody worried about? You know, you just carry your bottle of Roundup, that'll probably kill it. Your bottle of Lysol spray, some Raid, bug killer, you know, you just have all the shit with you and you'll be fine. Spray it on you, and you won't possibly contract this thing. But I'm sure that there's a degree of there is some kind of bug that people are getting. But I think it's more of an exercise in sort of a mass delusional hypochondria scenario in which people that are prone to get sick or to think they're sick are going to think they've got it. And then, but that's not the problem. The problem is that it's clear that in the same way that every kind of weird atmospheric abnormality or weird weather or anything like that in recent years is obviously attributed to
climate change.
Yes, that's climate change. The evil bogey carbon dioxide. They're both working on this thing together. And so anything, any kind of atmospheric or weather thing is attributable to climate change. And in the same way, any sickness now, if somebody sneezes, coughs, throws up, has a fit, bleeds from their nose, or anything is going to be, oh, look, they've got coronavirus. We must isolate them. We must amputate their organs. So it's all the scare thing. But what we do have to be at least somehow concerned about is not what the people who have it think, but what the people that are manipulating this whole scenario, what they're trying to do. And so it's obviously carte blanche for the neo-fascist planetary control regime to do whatever they want, because they've created these organizations of authority like the World Health Organization and the UN and all the shit, and they just gave themselves authority and people go along with it. And so they may or may not have guns, but people are going to assume that they have to listen and do what these people say. And so to a certain degree, you probably don't have to go along with it. But then they could say, well, you know, they could go like, oh, well, look, we have reason to believe that you might have this shit. So therefore, we're going to have now the legal right to detain you or lock you up or quarantine you or whatever, blah, blah, blah. Spray you with all this bug spray. But it's a recipe for totalitarian dictatorship to spread its tentacles everywhere. And so I'm about to find out next week when I do an international flight from Auckland to Hobart. I'm going to have to change in Melbourne. And I'm going to find out. I'm going to see exactly what it's all like. I mean, I've been, I personally have been, I'd be about at the lowest possible risk of anybody that could have it for several reasons. A, I've got an extraordinarily powerful immune system, and I don't even remember. It's been so many years since I actually got sick, other than maybe just like a little bit of a runny nose or here and there. I can't even remember how many years ago it was. And I just do my best to keep my immune system really, really strong, to eat a really healthful diet, take my Golden Seal and my Go-To Colon, my vitamin C, and eat plenty of raw fruits and vegetables and phytochemicals and green leafies and just everything. And so not only that, I've also been, because it's just how I like to be, I've been just about as isolated from people as it's possible to be, especially for the past 3 weeks. Here in Matapuri at this farmhouse, there's been many days that have gone by. In fact, many, many days in a row, maybe even a week, where I didn't even see another person. And the times I have only been for a few minutes. And, so I've spent very little time with people. And really, that's how I try to live for years. The only time I'm ever really around many people is when I have to travel. Like if I'm on a bus or a plane, or like even when I was on the boat coming from the South Island to the North Island a couple of weeks ago, I was outside. You know, so it's like I don't really... Even before this whole coronavirus bullshit, I'm sort of like wary about being in enclosed places with people anyway. Not because I'm scared of getting anything. I just don't like it. I don't like having to listen to other people. I don't like to have to hear them cough and snore and talk and all this different kind of stuff. I like to keep my distance as much as possible. So that has protected me. So, you know, I'm very lucky to have my travel agent that helped me for 6 years, back again now. His name's Matish Patel. If you ever need any state-of-the-art help based in New Zealand or ANZAC countries, his company's called Fusion Travel. That's FUZIONTRAVEL.co.nz. Matish Patel, they call him Meets. But he's a legendary, he's helped me out so many times, but he said his brother flew from Auckland to Melbourne last week and that it took longer than normal for it to go through the security, and they're just, I went like, what are they doing different? Because it's already been like, especially ever since 9/11, oh my God, I mean, it's lightened up a lot since then, but the amount of security stuff, you've got to verify how many fluids you have, like not in your body. Although I do have to say that crossing from Argentina back into Chile about 10 years ago, there was a sign that said, you must not transport semen across the border. So I went like, well, you know, I don't know how they're going to deal with that, because I'm sure I had some in me somewhere. Anyway, they didn't find out. Anyway, we'll see how much of a circus it is, because I don't know what they can do. What are they going to be doing? Like testing people there on the spot to see if they've got it? Because I don't know. Matish said that they're trying to verify where you've been. And so I don't know if they're going to be asking for documentation to show where you've been. I mean, my passport doesn't show anything because it's all electronic. You know, they could read that and see where I've gone. And you know, but there's all these stories in the media, and I don't know whether to believe it. I mean, some of them look like they're from mainstream sources like ABC, Australia, but I don't trust any of this shit anymore. And it's all, especially even as horrific as the Australia fires were, a lot of the stuff was deliberately exaggerated. And I think that it's the scare factor that for some reason tends to sell more of the mind share. That's what they're really selling. It used to be, if it bleeds, it leads. And then it was, if it burns, it earns. And I'm wondering what it could be now. I'll have to come up with one for the disease fear thing. But there's all kind of stories, like, it's quite funny, stores in Australia selling out of toilet paper. I mean, like, that's the main thing people are worried about, because everybody's shitting themselves. I mean, they're not worried about food. They're worried about wiping their ass when it comes out the other end. I mean, it's all a joke. And, you know, my guardian angels that have been the best anybody could ever possibly have, and they were honored in my last show. And I'd really like to thank my very, 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 very dear friends whose guardian angel wings span the galaxy, Jonathan and Michelle Beatty of Redlands, California. They've helped me so much, and they've got more of my art than anybody else. And we're doing a thing now where they've just commissioned me to do the third painting of this sacred... It's a geoglyph. It's kind of like a Native American Stonehenge kind of thing located near where they live. And part of it's been destroyed by construction, but most of it's intact. But they've been working on trying to buy the piece of land where it is, and they need $3 million. So Jonathan's going to take my painting and put it in a gallery in Laguna Beach and put a price tag of $3 million on my painting. Not necessarily that somebody's going to come along and pay that much, but to raise awareness for what it's actually for. This last piece of land not only would protect this geoglyph, which is kind of like a Native American Stonehenge, it's also the last missing link that would create a complete wildlife corridor going from the San Jacinto Mountains, I forget exactly what Jonathan said, all the way through the mountains of Southern California there. So I'd really like to help and make this happen any way I can. But speaking of Southern California, there's this really cool chick named Dana Ashley, whose videos I started seeing yesterday, and she talked a lot about just kind of a common sense approach to this whole coronavirus thing, which is more of a psyop than anything else. But I strongly recommend you watch some of her YouTube videos. Her name's Dana Ashley, A-S-H-L-I-E. And it's quite informative, and she's quite funny and reasonably well-informed. She admits that she's not a scientist, but she's trying to create awareness about all this stuff. And speaking of psyops, another thing that's been in the news a lot the past few months, but over recent years, is this guy from Australia named Julian Assange. He's the guy that came out with the whole WikiLeaks thing. I don't know how many years ago that was. At least 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, it seems like forever. And I don't really know his whole story, what he claimed that he used to do that gave him, or if he was a hacker or somehow gained access to this mass database of all these secret emails and messages and information and classified top secret files and all this stuff. And I still don't know. I never gave it any believability from day one. Just as it actually started happening around the time of global warming, it seemed to me, when that was the big thing. It all just seemed like a crock to me. Anyway, all along, I've been saying this from the beginning, but now they just keep, like, he was in extradition there, and where was he, in Ecuador for a while, and blah, 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 and then now they've extradited him, and he's been tortured and given drugs and tried to be poisoned and electrocuted and abused and not given a fair trial and all this stuff, and it's all just a crock of shit because, and pardon me for denigrating our feces, it's a crock of Trump because, I mean, the smoking gun is this. Anybody that represents any kind of real threat to the status quo of the power that be, the elite orchestrators and the secret government, anybody that's ever represented a serious threat to them, whether through the potential of their information they could reveal or their power to sway the public, like, for example, like John Lennon would be an example of the second category, who was clearly assassinated. Anybody that represented a threat would instantly be taken out using a wide variety of assassination techniques, many of which would be tried to be written off as suicides, like people committing suicide by cutting their arms off or shooting themselves in the back of the head, stuff like that as a joke, just to show that they're trying to get away with it. But and then people like John Denver, who I think was assassinated because his experimental airplane all of a sudden ran out of fuel because the tank was empty when he took off. So people don't understand why they would take him out. But he was very influential, a very positive, capable of moving people at the spiritual level, just like John Lennon. And some of John Denver's very last work, he did a song called Let Us Begin, What Are We Making Weapons For? Or maybe the reverse of that. But he was working with a singer from Russia. And when you see, I've got a video of him from 1993, of him talking about what he thought his very favorite songs and music was. And he said on there that he thought his very most important song ever was this song. And what it is, it's the story of his dad growing up as a coal miner in West Virginia. And then it's the story of this guy's dad growing up in Russia and how they, you know, they were trying to put food on their table for their families and stuff like that. And then it goes on to talk about how all the money spent on weapons and stuff could be much better used feeding people around the world. And so it's very much of a statement against the military-industrial complex. And there's even video footage of an American nuclear missile taken off that clearly shows the Westinghouse logo on there. And so I think that John Denver pissed off the powers that be and he was working with the Soviet government and musicians in doing all this too. Frank Zappa, another one who I think he was given radioactive substances that made him come down with very severe prostate cancer that killed him instantly. And again, all these things are plausibly deniable. John Lennon murdered by the lone gunman, just like JFK. John Denver's plane ran out of fuel. Frank Zappa got cancer, of course, because he smoked a lot. But he was getting ready to go into politics. He was going to run for Senate in California. And there's a really good chance he would have won, because he was very influential and very radical. And he even published in his biography his plans for the kind of changes he would make in the government if he got elected. And I think this started to scare a lot of people. And other people, Bhagwan Rajneesh, or Osho, for example, the Indian guru, he got arrested and was held in the jail in Charlotte, North Carolina, as he was trying to leave the country. And he died either in jail or shortly after thereafter. They think he was poisoned with polonium, this radioactive substance that the intelligence community is known for using to get rid of people. So the list goes on. So in other words, the point I'm trying to make is that anybody that, like even whistleblowers that have worked within weapons labs or weapons manufacturing facilities and knows stuff that's going on, like Karen Silkwood, for example, she had evidence of plutonium contamination, and she herself had been contaminated. They put plutonium in her bologna, in her refrigerator, and she set off all the alarm things, and she was on her way with documented evidence to meet some journalists when her car was run off the road and she was killed. So anybody that kind of represents a real threat is going to get taken out one way or the other, like very quickly. They're going to try to prevent this information from getting out. So anyway, that alone is proof that anything Julian Assange has ever done, and also that other bloke, Edward Snowden, that these dudes not only weren't taken out instantly, they've received like the maximum possible amount of publicity for years. I mean, many, many, many years. And it's not like they can hide from the intelligence community. And I don't know who Assange ever worked for, what he actually did. Wow, a cicada just came and landed on my piece of paper here. He might start making his sound. Very, very interesting. But Snowden worked for this corporation called Booz Allen and Hamilton in Langley, West Virginia. And they're a super spy organization that does work for everybody. And they're also heavily involved in geophysical warfare, and they employed Zbigniew Brzezinski's son, Ian, who now has his own group called the Brzezinski Group. If there was anybody involved with orchestrating geoterrorism, they also orchestrate and organize war games like RIMPAC, the biggest naval war game in the world. So they would be the ones that could organize stuff like that. Well, anyway, Edward Snowden worked for them. So for him to walk out of that place with an armload of classified documents ain't going to happen unless they wanted him to. You know, so that is the proof right there, all the proof that you need. So part of what these people like Danny Ashley and my friend Ashia Austin in Australia and other people, they're making the connection that this coronavirus seems to be related to the rollout of the 5G thing over there in that town, Wuhan in China. And so it's really complex and confusing trying to sort through all the information and disinformation, but it's entirely possible that this whole thing could be in part what people are getting as the symptoms of the coronavirus could be symptoms of radiation sickness from the ionizing radiation or even the non-ionizing radiation from the 5G frequency energies that are being transmitted. And this has to do with also with all these Starlink satellites that Elon Musk's company SpaceX is putting up. Another thing that the astronomers are up in arms about these change of these things going across the night sky everywhere. And I just have to mention that Duncan Frankensteel, the space scientist who I interviewed a few weeks ago, and he was going to write a book about disseminating genetically modified organisms on Mars. And so I called him Frankensteel. Well, he's also glorifying all these satellites that are going up. And saying like, oh, look how cool it is. Why don't we get a few more tens of thousands of them up there? So we'll all get really good internet. That's not what it's about. So what we're progressively doing is people are talking about, well, you know, what's the cure for cancer or you know, what's the cause of it? And I go like, well, if people stopped acting like cancer that's really what civilization is very much like. It's like a cancerous growth on the planet. If we stopped acting like cancer, we'd stop getting it. And even Jimi Hendrix talked about how in older cultures, they didn't really have diseases we know it. So a big part of it is the mutagenic influences that we're surrounding ourselves. And one of the biggest ones is electromagnetic. The whole electrification of the planetary biosphere, mainly thanks to Nikola Tesla and his alternating current. So we're pretty much constantly around these 60 hertz oscillations of alternating current, which is quite inimical to life, biological life as we know it. And this interacts with many other fields of interest, like the chemical, the radiological, the pharmaceutical, and also the information toxicology sphere that has to do with poisoning of your mind with false or misleading information, which is a whole thing I've talked about on my Regain Your Brain site. So I wouldn't worry about the coronavirus. It's what the people are trying to do to us, using that as an excuse, but I don't think it's going to go too far. Nothing like this has ever gone too far before. And so you know, I think they've also discovered that now, I mean, they're making up any possible excuse. The Onion beat me to it by talking about that the coronavirus was able to travel back in time. Or, there's a lot of room for humor there. It's made me think of this really good science fiction movie called The Andromeda Strain from about 1972. Michael Crichton's first book and movie. It's actually really good science fiction. I wanted to also acknowledge the passing 2 weeks ago of one of the best piano and keyboard players that I ever knew. His name was Lyle Mays, L-Y-L-E-M-A-Y-S, and he was best known for his work with Pat Metheny and the Pat Metheny Group. And I got to meet him a couple of times. Absolute brilliant keyboard player. Their music was some of the nicest music I think that's ever been made in the popular domain. But his fingers were like half again as long as mine. So he had like piano playing hands. And that was really sad. And it was interesting that this has got me listening to a lot of early Pat Metheny music. And when I first met him and Lyle Mays backstage in Atlanta in 1981, and Steve Morse of the Dixie Dregs was back there too, and I met all these guys. And at this time I was organizing this special project that involved doing music with whales and dolphins in a radio telescope. It's what put me in touch with Arthur C. Clarke. Anyway, I talked with these guys about to see if they'd be interested in participating in this project, and they were very excited about it. And so then Pat went on to I saw them live, I guess it was later that same year, at the Hollywood Bowl in Hollywood, California, and his new album called Off Ramp had just come out. And it blew me away because the sound that he created, he had a new instrument called a synclavier that Frank Zappa also pioneered some of the early work with it too. And I got to record on one in Pasadena in 1987. But Pat Metheny came out with a sound that sounded a lot like a cross between a trumpet, a whale, and an elephant. And it was kind of like if Miles Davis was in a zoo, what it might have sounded like. But that was really cool. And then he came out with an album called Rejoicing that had Charlie Hayden on bass and a drummer. I forget who the drummer was, but anyway, he did three songs. This was vinyl that came out, and the second side of the album was three songs, and it was a trio dedicated to his encounter with me and that project I talked about. And I know this for a fact, Pat never told me himself, but my friends in Atlanta, when he played that time in Atlanta, they heard him talking on the radio and talking about this. So anyway, but these songs are called Story from a Stranger, The Calling, and Waiting for an Answer. So that was very, very, very interesting. And I'd also like to acknowledge that on March 2nd was the birthday, I think the 102nd birthday, of Dr. Seuss, the very famous artist who did all the children's books. And so he's one of my favorite artists of all times. So now, after I've already talked for 30 minutes, I can get to talking about comets. Comets and asteroids are kind of the same thing, but and there's not really a very well demarked boundary between them, but a lot of comets have sort of more volatile material that's capable of creating outgassing or possibly ionization as they approach the sun. But comets are big chunks of rock and ice that are in orbits around the sun, and then not all of them. There are interstellar ones that come through now and then. But there tend to be all kinds of different families of comets. And there's probably a very large number of them, like probably 10 to the 10th power when you add in all the different possible bodies that are in the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud and all these different sort of family regions where they live. And like Duncan Steele said, it's like how many grains of sand are on a beach or how many rocks. It depends on how small you want to go down to. So if you go down to ones that are the size of a grain of sand, there'd probably be like, I don't know, 10 to the 20th power. I mean, uncountable. But we don't really need to worry about those. And not that we need to worry about any of them, but I guess part of the gist of the whole interest in comets is how many times the Earth has encountered them up close and been impacted. That's kind of the crux of the whole thing. The cicada did make a sound for me there. But yeah, my own personal history with comets is very interesting. I'd also like to acknowledge that on the 7th of March, which is tomorrow, on the 7th of March, tomorrow will be the 50th anniversary of the longest solar eclipse that I ever saw, and only one of two that I've seen a total solar eclipse in my life. But this was one that went down the east coast of America in March 7th of 1970. And it was, I remember, we went down to the beach to be within the path of totality, but it was amazing because it was dark like the whole day. And this one had over 7 minutes of totality, which is just about, it was close to being the maximum length of totality that it's ever possible to have because of being, you know, the distances between the sun and the earth and the moon and all that different kind of stuff. So that was really, really cool. So on February 15th, I had the 20th anniversary of my first setting foot in New Zealand. And on tomorrow, it'll be the 50th anniversary of seeing the longest solar eclipse that I've ever seen. So probably the first comet I saw was, I believe, Comet Kohoutek, in whenever that was, in the 1970s. I believe that I remember taking pictures of that and stuff. I had already fallen in love with astronomy in 1968 and was going to be an astronomer, and then started doing photography in 1970. But my dad gave me these two little books when he returned from a trip in 1968, and one of them was a little book called Field Guide to the Stars. It was a little book of maps that showed all the constellations and stuff, and that book was just so magical. It was like a doorway to the universe. And he also gave me a book called Worlds in Collision by Immanuel Bielakowski. And I just read that with utter delight, and it was so cool because he was talking about events in the Bible and all this. That was my first encounter with sort of more kind of an esoteric way of looking at comets and stuff as influences on the history of life. And all this was, of course, in my unconscious mind, but I never really thought about it all that much. But then I was pursuing being an astronomer in college, and then I started painting in 1978, right around the time that I really fell in love with the dolphins and stuff. And the very first painting I ever did, the second painting I did, was kind of an impressionistic landscape with kind of a gnarly dead tree and a full moon, but with this kind of misty-like, vapor-like stuff going around it. And in some ways, it kind of looks like it could be a big comet, or it could look like cloudy, nebulae, debris, dust, or vapor or something surrounding the moon. But anyway, it's kind of eerie, but it's very kind of cataclysmic, Bielakowskian looking. So comets have been very influential in the history of life on Earth. And it's not something that a lot of people are aware of, but I've really been looking into it a lot in recent years, especially in the wake of an event that happened to me in late October of 2015. If you look at my art around that time, there was maybe the occasional comet. I know I did a landscape painting based on my time in Chile, and I put a comet in the sky then. That was from 2006 or 2007, I think. And so I would put the occasional comet in a painting, but I didn't really put that much significance on them. But I've been swimming with this pod of dolphins almost every day for a week, and felt very, very, very tight with them psychically. And after getting out of the water and coming back and sitting at my painting table, this was on Farafara Beach on Aotea, or Great Barrier Island, Netherlands Beach. And I was sitting there painting, and all of a sudden, wham, this image appeared in my mind, unlike anything I had ever experienced before. And I drew down a picture of it, and I knew that it was a telepathic transmission from the dolphins. And I instantly knew what it was and what it was supposed to be. It was a representation or an impression of what a comet or an asteroid might look like during the brief window of time of a second or two when it's passing through the atmosphere on its way to hit a point on the Earth close to where the observer was. So it wasn't streaking across the sky sideways like we normally think of comets. It was coming straight at the observer. And so the two implicit messages from this transmission were that ancestors of these dolphins had seen this and transmitted this image into their collective consciousness, but also that something like this was going to happen again soon, and that the whales and dolphins are able to perceive and understand and detect and sense this kind of information based on their connection with water, and they're able to know what's going on in the heliocosm in ways that we aren't, and that we might kind of have kind of an inkling about through our advanced electronic satellite technologies, but even not so much with that, because they're able to sense it and feel it directly as part of their own internal biological technology that they've had, that's never become atrophied or dulled, and that they still rely on to live in the world. So this is what really put me on red alert level for comets, and I started sort of trying to delve into who the major comet researchers were. This led me to go and visit a guy named Malcolm Hartley that worked at Siding Spring Observatory in the Warrumbungles in Australia, and then I got in touch with Fred Watson, who used to be the director there. And it was Fred Watson who first told me about Victor Kluge and Bill Napier, the legendary comet astronomers, who came out with some very big picture papers in the late 70s and early 80s that was actually before Walter and Luis Alvarez came out with their theory about, based on their discovery of the iridium layer, that, and then it had to do with the, they believed that this had to do, this cometary impact had to do with the mass extinction event of 65 million years ago. And I won't use the word cause, because it's much more complex than that. So anyway, I've got in touch with all these people. And then Malcolm Hartley had a book by Duncan Steele called Rogue Planets and Doomsday Asteroids, or something like that. And I read part of it there, got in touch with Duncan Steele. He sent me a couple of articles, but then fell out of touch. And then I was able to interview him just a few weeks ago in Nelson. But much to my dismay, he's not really doing the comet and asteroid thing anymore. He's working with information from satellites and trying to put genetically modified organisms on Mars. So one of the most interesting things about Bielakowski, like astronomers, even Bill Napier, and I haven't asked Victor Kluge yet, but they pretty much implicitly admit the major influence that Emanuel Bielakowski was on their early thinking, but they almost, Fred Watson, Duncan Steele, and Bill Napier all deride Bielakowski now. And I go, but look, I think the problem is that he was very much like Thomas Gold, only even a much bigger thinker than that. He was a psychoanalyst by profession. Not an astronomer, not a geologist, but he delved into these fields and communicated with some of the top minds in these areas in order to try to ascertain what was really going on with state-of-the-art knowledge. And he admits he's not an astronomer or geologist, so when you look, not all of his astronomical or geological ideas would necessarily hold water in terms of mainstream science, but his main forte was his psychological or psychoanalytic contributions. And that's where these people need to look and to try to really understand who he was and what his ideas and messages were. But a lot of his ideas are extraordinarily profound. But that he talks about how cataclysmic evolution, which is actually not a proper use of the word cataclysm, because kataklysmos in Greek means destruction only by water. So catastrophic evolution would be a better word, but he's saying that in contrast to the Darwinian idea of a long, slow, uniformitarian process of very gradual evolution by natural selection, Bielakowski's saying that the evolution and appearance of new life forms has been much more equally, if not more so, influenced by these, all of a sudden, these relatively sudden events that have happened geologically that are impacts or encounters with comets and asteroids that have happened repeatedly, like probably many, 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 many thousands or even tens of thousands of times in the history of life on Earth. And some of them we know about, but most of them we don't. Most of the geological evidence is gone because of the dynamics of the surface of the Earth, and a lot of any of them would have hit in the ocean, you know, but we do know that. And so one of the biggest important work that's going on now that Bill Napier and Victor Kluge are talking about is their sort of their big picture model of how this all works. they're not talking about one event like the Alvarez team. They're talking about a model for how the sun moves within our arm of the galaxy. And as it traverses the plane of the galaxy periodically, sort of a wave of oscillation, this brings us into areas of higher density of what they call planetesimals. These are objects that might range, well, it just depends on what size range you want to look at, but from, you know, the size of like a kilometer up to 10 or 100 kilometers in diameter, up to ones the size of the moon. The galaxy's filled with innumerable of these objects, and so we have these periodic waves that they think correlates with kind of the cycle of mass extinctions, which might bring what they call episodic bombardment or cometary waves that bring periods of greater mass extinctions that have, and so it might even be, I mean, we're talking about, we're not just talking about geological time, we're talking about galactic time. The amount of geological ages that occur or that pass between the time when the Earth, the Sun, passes through the galactic plane and then does it again. So this kind of thinking, this kind of model is also moving towards an explanation of what could be some of the driving forces behind the sort of seasonal variations that the Hindu mythology describes as the yugas. That's Y-U-G-A-S. They're sort of long-term seasons of the galactic year that they define it spiritually as being sort of different ages during which people are under sort of different weather. They relate them to metals, gold, silver, copper, and iron. And so, but they're just talking about the yugas in the sense of history since people have been here, which is, you know, could be hundreds of thousands or millions of years. We don't really know. There could be, the Hopis say that we're in the fourth world of human life, and so there could have been advanced civilizations before this one. That's what the Hopis say, that were taken out because of they were such a threat to life on Earth, which is what we've become now. So if a civilization like Atlantis, for example, got taken out by a cometary impact or the implications or aftermath of that, like a tidal wave or a tsunami, earthquake, volcanic eruptions, all of these things are related. Is that random, or is it a teleological, spiritual function of the universe? And so this is one of the big sort of dilemmas or conundrums or questions or paradoxes that I tend to look at when I look at all this stuff. It's a big, big, big topic, but I've learned how to pronounce the name of the comet that is probably the one that was most familiar, and it's E-N-C-K-E. I always called it Enki, but it's actually Anka, and I know that because my friend Selena from Germany, on my friend's sailboat last week, there's a kind of a spool that they wrap the cables around on the boat, and the manufacturer's name is Anka, E-N-C-K-E. That's what it says on top of this little spool. So she told me how to pronounce it. So he was the astronomer. He didn't discover this comet, but he's who first calculated its orbital period. And people believe, like, this is what Bill Napier's new article is talking about how Anka, as a progenitor comet, used to be huge, but it fragmented. And so its daughters have been responsible for a lot of impacts and encounters throughout human history. And it could be that in the skies of not that many thousands of years ago, there were many more comets that were visible. They were like, you know, there would have been many comets in the sky at one time. They were always there. And the fact that some of these, that people knew that they could impact the Earth, or that the Earth could go through its tail and bring down a lot of meteoric dust or clouds of dust and vapor or even microbes. This could be related to the whole panspermia idea of how life originated, or how microorganisms, spores and microbes and stuff, or even Terence McKenna's idea of mushroom spores brought here, traveling from space and coming here and taking hold, influencing life here viruses, what we know about viruses. If you look at a picture of one, it looks like a little nanotechnology. Even before the era of nanotechnology, viruses already look like that, as if they could be possibly their nanotechnologies that are left over from previous incarnations of civilization. How could we possibly know? But it's also interesting to think about comets as being not just chunks of ice and rock, but as gods or deities or beings. You know, we think of Mother Earth as Gaia, and we have all the ancient Greek and Roman and Mesopotamian and Sumerian names for the gods, and one of the major comets was called Phaeton, Phaeton. So the people of ancient times wrote about all these as the gods, and they waged war among themselves, which Emmanuel Wielkowski calls Theomachy. That's Theomachy. Theomachy. And also, another big point is that impacts from these comets and asteroids have induced true global climate change that might have persisted for thousands of years and might have had to deal with the lofting of meteoric dust and smoke from volcanoes that would dim the sun and therefore cool the earth and make photosynthesis impossible and drive animals to extinction because of lack of food. Just like what's just happened in Australia, it's like a small version of this. So anyway, all this stuff that I'm just kind of mentioning now is all part and parcel of what comets mean to me, and this is very much of an ongoing area of research in my own life, and I'm going to be communicating with Victor Kluge and also my wonderful friend Kate Burness created a beautiful little book called A Comet's Tale that I've got a PDF of that I might send out along with this email. And so the implication is that another serious impact or encounter with a comet or asteroid could theoretically happen again any time. And we know the two windows of time during which the Earth crosses the fragments of Anka are late October and early November, and late June and early July. And it was late June 30th, when the Tunguska explosion happened in Russia, and it was late October when this dolphin transmission to me happened. And I didn't even know about this, the Anka window at this time. So it's all very, very, very interesting. And I think that the whales and dolphins know about all this stuff, and the indigenous people, primarily of Australia, the whale dreaming people who were very intimately connected with the whales and dolphins, also have or had this kind of knowledge. And so when I return to Australia next week, I'm going to be going on a major healing expedition in honor of all my families of life that were so severely impacted by these fires. I'm going to be flying into Hobart and then continuing up along the Great Ocean Road, maybe to Garryward, the Grampians, maybe to Kangaroo Island, to the Flinders Ranges, Wilpena Pound, to the Central Desert, Uluru, Attila, Katajuta, to the top end, Darwin, Litchfield, Nipmulot, Kakadu, Arnhem Land, and down through Western Australia, Karajini, Hammersley, Pernalulu, El Cuestro, and try to visit some of the Guion, the Bradshaw rock art in the Kimberley, visit the Kennedy Ranges in Mount Augustus, a large rock that's three times bigger than Uluru, Cape Range, Exmouth, Kalberry, Denham, Denmark, D'Entrecasteaux, Valley of the Giants, Pemberton. Oh my God. And then I'm hoping to still be in Australia in July for what will be my 20th anniversary there on the 1st of July, the day the GST took effect. But I'd really like to thank John and Peggy and Garlic out on Great Barrier for their love and support, and John and Renee here at Montipuri for this beautiful visit, and my friend Kate Burness and Julia, my Russian geologist friend, and Ian McAllister and Steve Hazy down in Christchurch, and all my beautiful friends in the spirit of Tasmania. And please wish me luck on getting through the circus gauntlet next week through the airport and all that stuff, but it's all going to be good, and my next show will be recording from Tasmania. So this is Jeff Phillips-Wefferson signing off. Kia Manuya. That means live long and prosper in Rarotonga.
Good day.